But it was not only in employment that there was discrimination and the lack of equality, but also in housing and in the social service system that permeates the whole, you know, the whole living conditions of Indian people. Mm-hmm. That means poor health services. Discrimination that that really wasn't answered for Indian people by the Civil Rights Act of the 1950s, in which the black people were mainly responsible for passage. While that law, as it reads, gave all people, you know, actual civil rights, it really changed very little in terms of employment opportunities, access to good housing, access to good education, the whole life of Indian people. And of course the American Indian Movement moved very swiftly and grew very quickly and in large numbers because of its successes in the city of St. Paul. But the real starting point of the American Indian Movement was the police brutality on the part of the Minneapolis mm-hmm. Police Department against Indian people on the streets. Mm-hmm. The Minneapolis Police Department of the city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, their attitude and their treatment of Indian people is very akin to the mm-hmm. Gestapo tactics of the Nazi regime. And to some extent, that is still there, although it's somewhat lessened now. So that is the back, the root background. But then from there, we began reaching out into other fields. We actually staged some large demonstrations on behalf of equal opportunity. And one of the earliest that I can remember is that there was a program that was established by the federal government in which minorities and underprivileged people were given a program in which they could upgrade their existing skills or the establishment of new skills, which was supposed to then give you access and opportunity to get into the working mainstream. And that just wasn't so for Indian people. And so there was a large demonstration for that, and in turn brought about some change in that program. And the momentum just carried us on into other things. And then shortly after, those kinds of successes and challenges brought us to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And we began to move, as I said, in other directions. And soon it became, statewide. And then pretty mm-hmm. soon we were moving into other states and other causes mm-hmm. and other groups. And they were coming to us largely because that we had demonstrated mm-hmm. that we can change things. After a period of time, it began to become clear to us that the problem for Native American people was awesome. I mean, it wasn't only local that the problems we were experiencing in the state of Minnesota were also true in other parts of the country for Indian people, and it didn't really matter what tribe or anything, as long as you were Indian, you were at the short end of the stick. So many things happened, and we went many places, and it was political confrontation. There was no violence. We didn't do violent tactics, but many times violence was put upon us by police, by the watchdogs of society, you know. Mm-hmm. And so many times the violent confrontations that did occur were merely acts of defense on our part, but of course it wasn't reported in the media in that manner. And many times we've been accused of staging those things so that we could get mass media attention. Well, that really is not true. But it is true on the part of the mass media in America is that that's what they look for, is the sensationalism, the violent confrontations. Yeah. Those are the things that sell newspapers, and those are the acts that people look for on television. And while those kinds of things do put you on the front pages and get you on the 6 o'clock and the 10 o'clock news, they really don't answer. They don't really answer the question or address the issue.
Yeah.
Because what people are fed over the television is exactly what the commentator wishes to say about it, and what you see in the moving pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
They never say anything about why. They never address the housing, the health conditions, the unemployment, the poverty. You know, it's never stated. So we began then to find ways and means and how to use the media, and we became very skillful at that. And because of that, then we began to enjoy wider attention and wider audience. And of course, because of that, then people did begin to pay attention. And of course, then we spread out first into South Dakota, then into other states, and pretty soon, it became a national thing. And our numbers, our supporters and members began to grow just in real large volumes. It was primarily young people at the beginning. But because we always felt, I always felt that we should have consultation from the elders, then it became an elder, youth-oriented movement.
Is it true that in the beginning, the elders or the spiritual leaders on the reservations were sort of very hesitant to take part because they thought that the young people who staged the first things were just political militants.
They
had a different course from reservation traditionalists.
Well, that's true to an extent.
But it's been overcome, no?
Yeah, it's been totally. They see the larger problem now. It was very hard for people, not only spiritual leaders, but people on the reservation in general, to see that we were addressing all Indian problems, really. And not limiting ourselves just to the Minneapolis area, because what is true in Minneapolis is also true on the reservation in another form. So then what happened is we began to reach out into other sectors and other causes and issues. And after the confrontation at Washington, D.C., which happened on the eve of Tricky Dick Nixon's landslide victory, where again the federal government broke their promise. Prior to that, we had developed, with the help of Indian tribes and Indian groups all over the country, a 20-point solution paper. We sent that on into Washington 2 weeks before the arrival of the Trail of Broken Treaties. And we received word back that yes, we would have access to the Secretary of Interior, to the Secretary of State, indeed to the White House, and that it was a very good thing, and that these points we were raising in the 20-point solution paper addressed itself to tribal rights, employment opportunities, educational opportunity, educational reforms, land rights, treaty rights. Protection of natural resources, care and maintenance of existing Indian lands. Those were, in essence, what was contained in a 20-point solution paper. And they were received with great enthusiasm and great hope by the people in Washington, D.C. But then, of course, when we arrived, the situation had changed. Of course, we now know that we were infiltrated by the FBI, and in part they were responsible for the breakdown of communications then. Who made that decision, I don't know, but certainly somebody did. So when on our arrival to Washington, all of the arrangements that had been made there were like 4,000 Indian people that arrived in Washington on the Trail of Broken Treaties. And they represented from the very young to the very old and almost all tribal groups. The government went into a defensive position and maintained that we did not represent the constituted majority, they would deal only with the elected tribal leaders. And so then and there they put a wedge even between the ranks of Indian people, saying that we were from the urban areas and we represented no tribal voices, and, which wasn't true. But that's the tactic they used. And of course they surrounded us with their troops and their guns and armor and helmets and police dogs and everything else. And we just held forth in the building that supposedly is ours, the Bureau of Indian Affairs building, which we thought was quite a turnaround. You know, they were trying to oust us from our supposed building. And, of course, that led to a confrontation, but we found out many things there. We now know that President Nixon did not want any kind of a scene at the time because the election results were not in yet. But he did agree to meet, his top advisors would meet with a team of ours, and I was selected as a part of that negotiation team. And we met them, 10 of us met with representatives of the president and the White House. Very honorable, upstanding, moral Americans, patriots. Haldeman, Ehrlichman. Very, very prestigious citizens of the nation. That's who we dealt with. Mm-hmm. And of course, in those negotiations, one of the things that we said is that we want these issues addressed. We want to see the Secretary of State. We want to see the Secretary of Interior. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of Education. All of the things that were contained in that. We wanted to see the people who could make the decisions. Yeah. We did not want to see somebody who's in charge of some obscure office. We wanted to see the man who could make the decisions now. And if that meant seeing the president then is who we wanted to see. So we were assured then that, you know, yes, they'd get a hearing. Yes, yes, it would be looked at. Would we please now vacate the building?
Yeah.
And we said, we'll vacate the building after we, after we have talked about this. So, always there was a threat. See, we were surrounded by, you know, by the elements of Department of Justice, the Army. In fact, they had a battalion of paratroopers who were on standby to raid us.
Yeah.
But Nixon was in a very awkward position because he was on the eve of his election and really did not want to have anything focused on him at that time. After several days of jockeying back and forth, then the president sent word that all those things would be taken care of, and to help us get back home, kind, benevolent government and the citizens of America would donate to us $66,000. The media and America in general was led to believe that that was government funds and actually taxpayers' money. We now know that it was not government money or taxpayers' money. That money actually came from an organization called CREEP. And that was an organization that it was actually the committee to re-elect the president, and all very dirty money. That's the source of those funds. We didn't know that at the time.
That's the people who are also responsible for the Watergate.
Yes, yes. And that is the connection there.
Yeah.
$66,000 was like a small drop in a large bucket to them, with the traffic of millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the $66,000 was a mere pittance, really.
Mm.
But of course, they saw to it that the media played real football with it, and the media was given Indians are given $66,000 in party money, and just really played that up big. Of course, now that we have discovered that that money was part of the Watergate, all the Watergate scandal, nothing is said about it.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I returned to St. Paul, as and other people returned to their homes. And we were waiting then for the results.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, word came down that no, there would not be an address to those issues. And at the same time, the people of the Oglala Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, were having their problems. They asked the American Indian Movement to come there. So we went there at the invitation of the Oglala Civil Rights Organization. And after several days of meetings and negotiations with the local unit of BIA and others about their particular problems, it was found that there was going to be no solutions there either.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what ensued then is the occupation of Wounded Knee. And Wounded Knee was a calculated, well-thought-out plan, because we were fairly certain that the government was going to react in a violent fashion again.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, if America is bent on exterminating us, then let's go to the place where they had the last massacre. Wounded Knee was that site, and it happens to be on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And that is why Wounded Knee was selected.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had we had failed to open the door at in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Yeah.
Washington, D.C. is the seat of justice and honor and
democracy.
We failed to receive it there, and we thought, what better place?
Mm-hmm.
If America is going to have a history, let it happen at Wounded Knee, because that's where part of their history does lie buried. So that is why Wounded Knee was selected. And of course, that is history now. In total, nine people lost their lives, and countless others lost their lives. There have been assassinations.
Mm.
There was a great clamor over the death of two FBI agents, but absolutely nothing has been said about the 27 Indians who've been shot and killed by BIA police, other government agents, and the assassinations. Absolutely nothing is said.
I got reports that this is actually still going on Pine Ridge, that people get shot in the back.
Oh, yes.
I think... was it Russell Means was shot in the back on Pine Ridge a couple of years later?
Yes, yes.
And other people.
There have been attempts on other people. And so the government then took that turn. Now, what the government has been doing for the past, since that time, of course, is they've virtually tied us up in court. Excessively high bails on trumped up charges.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are in prison now because of that. So,
what's for the question here? What can, do you think, if anything at all, can the public in this country do to help get people out of jails?
Well,
I know about the case of Leonard Kredor, where I think Amnesty International certainly did help because
he
did get free after a while.
Yes.
Do you think that this would be a sort of tactics that people outside America should pursue to help?
That's one of them. That's one of the tactics.
Mm.
I've got to say here that, you know, we are very, very thankful for people outside the United States for their help in getting Leonard Crowdog, a spiritual leader, a holy man, freed from prison. Because his only crime was actually his being Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to defend his way of life. That is his only crime. And I've got to say, I've got to give all credit due to people who signed petitions, who wrote letters, who expressed their shock and dismay. And he's now free and he's home. And it's a good victory there. But there are many other people still in prison. So that is one thing that can be done. There are now survival schools in the
mm-hmm.
10 survival schools in the country that are operating without federal or state
mm-hmm.
government funds,
mm-hmm.
and that's an attempt to alleviate the real high dropout rate of Indian students from the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
When we've asked the public schools to change, to become more sensitive to the needs of Indian students, but it's not
mm-hmm.
forthcoming.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that there was a report once, I think it was a Senate subcommittee, and was it Robert Kennedy was involved in that as well, going through BIA schools, looking at facilities there and finding out how bad the situation was? Did this committee and the report, did they ever show any sort of results in changing the situation, do you think? Or
well, there have been some surface changes.
From the white side?
No. There's still, I guess the biggest problem there is just general American apathy towards the problems of Indian people. People just don't seem to care.
Yeah.
Doesn't affect them, therefore why should I bother? It seems to be is the attitude of America in general.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those subcommittees, and there has been a lot of activity, not only on the part of Indian folks, but on the part of some conscientious people in America. But their voice is very small,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you're bucking a huge, huge system.
Yeah.
And a very insensitive system. So while we tried those tactics, we found out, it was just useless
mm-hmm.
as an exercise in futility. So the only answer then is to establish your own schools
yeah.
where you can do those changes. And we, of course, we always believe in self-determination. That means that that's another expression of self-determination, that
mm-hmm.
Indian parents should play a role in and a selection in the kind of education that their kids want. After what I just described, I have decided that shall be my
mm-hmm.
my particular field. I've dedicated and put forth all of my efforts now in education. Other folks are still, struggling with the justice system in other parts.
Mm-hmm.
My own particular field of endeavor then is in alternative education.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Red Schoolhouse came.
Can you try to sort of give a description to young people in general who go to white schools here and how your school and curriculum and what has been done differs from what you've seen of white German schools over here or white American schools?
Well, the public school system, of course, is dedicated to the premise that students shall become good citizens,
mm-hmm.
taxpayers, and homeowners. And they do that in a very regimented, inflexible way. And the philosophy and the concept of American education, of course, is very competitive. You have to get the best grades, and the best students are advanced. And the whole attention is based on that. So that means that if you are a slower achiever, then then what is structured in a school, you get largely forgotten. And there's no remediation of that, because education in America is a linear process. You go from point one to two to three and so on, and you're expected inflexibly to achieve those things and those skills in a linear fashion. And that's where education then stops. It doesn't take into consideration the total person. It doesn't take into consideration tribal or traditional customs. It doesn't take into consideration your spiritual, mental well-being. You either get an A or a lesser mark. And so it has no compassion to it, really. And that is what's missing for Indian students. And I must say here that it's not only Indians who are feeling this. Many students are feeling this. But white students in general can cope with that because that's the kind of environment they come from. You're taught very early that you do your neighbor before he does you. So you can cope with that, and that translates into the school too. So you know the public schools, you know, it's a very real question of whether they are educating, and there's a very real question about whether the students are students or just consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basic thing about public schools, and Indian students are dropping out of those public schools at a 65% rate, which is a very low yield success ratio. So then America would have you believe then, well, yes, that's true, students do drop out, but 80% of them do make it through. Well, that's fine. The 80% then are okay, but what happens to the 20%? And that's who we are concerned about, the 20% that are so turned off by a teacher's system, the whole atmosphere. What happens to them?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing will happen to them. So we have decided that an alternative must be put forth. So we're in our seventh year.
What is the sort of legal situation? And in Germany, it's also said that well, everybody must go to school and they must be state-approved, and if you don't go to a state-approved school, you're forced to go to such a school. I don't know what the legal system would be in America, but what is the status as compared with white schools in America? Any problems there or difficulties?
At the beginning there was some problems, but we are a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And private schools largely, in the sense, private schools are mainly the schools that may have a specific kind of a curriculum. Mainly private schools up to this point have been maybe religiously oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a charter. We are chartered as a non-profit private school.
Mm-hmm.
We have a board of directors that is composed of Indian parents and students.
Mm-hmm.
That's whom we answer to, and then there's a parents advisory committee. That's the structure of our school. But again, it points out Indian participation, Indian parental participation in the process. Legally, we never sought, nor did we ever feel the need to have state sanction or state approved schools. We're just saying that your system doesn't work for this set of kids, and we have something that does, and we're proving it very, very adequately this year. June will be our fourth graduation exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And the results are, of the 19 people that have since graduated from our school with a high school diploma, 11 of them are in a college or university program somewhere. 4 of them are working with us in a teacher aide capacity. 1 is working as a teacher aide while attending college.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's so the success.
So I couldn't say that the students who come from the survival schools are usually also those who become most active in the Indian struggle for self-determination.
Yes.
Because they're aware of their heritage and they found their roots.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I guess that if you wanted to have a definition of what do we do,
mm-hmm.
I guess the first thing that we do for Indian kids is give them back their identity.
Mm-hmm.
You give them back their identity and then they have something to be proud of and you build from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not strictly a matter of reading, writing, and achieving achieving good grades. Our school is concerned with a total development of of the student, totally.
And how are those skills you just mentioned, like reading, writing, so handled in connection with projects? Or you told me about this program that you have, this curriculum you have about the Ojibwa drums.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be that something like writing is taught in connection with such an a project that they are asked to write a report on something? So, or are there lessons like we have in white schools just for reading, just for writing, or is it all put together in projects or programs like the one you described earlier?
Well, we have in the Red Schoolhouse we offer all of the basics,
mm-hmm.
because we realize that in order to know the tools of survival, which is reading and writing, we must know them very well. If we are going to save our lands, it has to be through law and through the court. Well, you don't get very far in law and in the court scene if you don't know how to read or write. So we emphasize that we must learn how to read and write English very, very well. But it's taught from a different perspective. And in that I'm describing that we must, in order to protect our identity, our culture, our land, our future, we must learn this.
So could one say that you try not to teach under the confusion of means and ends or something? Here, writing is an end in itself. You must be able to write.
Yes.
But for you, it's just a means to achieve another end, namely be Indian. Right.
It's integrated in the whole living process.
Yeah.
We have at the school what we call a culture-based curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
We use concepts and terms that are relevant to our culture, and we use them as learning tools. Geometry, mathematics is taught from an Indian perspective. In the teaching of geometry, for instance, we use the concept of the circle, the four directions, as geometrical figures from which you start. That's an example of culture-based curriculum. We will use music, the study of music. Again, we'll take music from different parts of the world and say, this is how it sounds in Afghanistan, this is how it sounds in Africa, in Ireland, wherever. But here in America, this is the true folk music, and it's our music. Feel folk music of Afghanistan might sound funnier than hell to you, but it doesn't sound funny to the Afghanistans. Our music happens to sound probably very funny to the white European and American ear, but there's a lack of appreciation because there's a lack of understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's nothing more beautiful than to hear a night chant, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know that a lot of people are removed from that,
mm-hmm.
and the only thing you can hear is the clamor and the cacophony of rock music,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in order then to make that comparison, we say, all right, here is rock music. But rock music is not the end or the last, because it has its roots in other things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so our music. So music is taught from that perspective. Science is taught from the Indian perspective again.
I could imagine that what we probably call biology or so would be very important, like plants
yes.
and
mm-hmm.
animals.
Yeah. And see, in the imparting of information on biology and plants and the related sciences, we don't stop at the book. We go out into the woods and mm-hmm. say, this is what this looks like,
mm-hmm.
and this is what it's good for. It's an edible plant, or it's a healing plant, mm-hmm. or it's a plant from which we can extract a color.
Mm-hmm.
Its uses.
Yeah.
And of course, we don't include the Latin term for it. We include the Ojibwe term
mm-hmm.
for it. So, what we're saying is that education must be a total process. It can't stop at the books, at the compilation of data. While that is very useful
mm-hmm.
as a reference point, it does not give you the feel of the
mm-hmm.
of the plant. That must be experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing.
Just said that, and I hope at least most educators would agree with you that education is a continuous process that should not only take part in a school lesson or in a book, but involves the whole of life. How is the community involved, or is there a split between for the students between school life and lessons and private life at home or in the community, or do you try to integrate those?
One of the miracles of the school is that it's become like a community center for the entire community. It's not strange to see parents walk in with their newborn child
mm-hmm.
and sit and watch a class and even sometimes participate. It's not
mm-hmm.
very strange to see elders, grandmothers and grandfathers come in. And of course they're brought right into the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And ideas are exchanged with them, their views are considered.
Mm-hmm.
And in our school, everybody has a voice. A teacher is not a person whom you cannot question.
Mm-hmm.
A teacher is somebody you can question
mm-hmm.
At any time. It's a very different atmosphere. It's a very different kind of thing. Teachers are work with small numbers of people. And they are not the last word. They're not the last authoritative word on anything. You share your skills, but then the students share theirs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very different from a public school. And of course, our school, the teachers are seen at the social functions.
Mm-hmm.
They visit students'
mm-hmm.
homes,
mm-hmm.
Spend overnight in some homes. So they're seen not only in the classroom. You go camping with them, maybe you go to a ball game with
mm-hmm.
teachers, and they are normal, everyday people.
Yeah.
And we don't have a 9-to-5 schedule. If the kids really are interested in talking about a subject, any subject, for as long as they want to pursue that, they're allowed to pursue that. While we do have a somewhat of a schedule,
mm-hmm.
we are not bound to that. We don't restrict ourselves to saying Shakespeare is only going to be studied from 9 o'clock until 10 o'clock. If kids want to pursue Shakespeare beyond that until 10:15, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Then we go to the next class.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very flexible. But nonetheless, even in spite of its flexibility, we do try to maintain some
mm-hmm.
kind of. But it's not so rigid that
mm-hmm.
if you don't get it done today, there's tomorrow.
Perhaps you could also tell us something. You mentioned something earlier to David. Try to convey to the listeners what the alternative would be for an Indian child if it isn't lucky enough to get to a survival school. What other schools are there, and how, I might as well say, bad are they, like boarding schools?
Many times there is no choice. For many of the people living on reservations, the conditions of reservation life is so destitute and so lacking in many things that many times boarding school is an escape. Many times you really don't have that much of a choice and almost no alternatives. And so many times the students are stuck in situations that they really have no control over. Parents often will send their children to boarding schools because they don't have the means to provide anything else. While there has been some change in the boarding schools, it is not complete enough. It is not. It's not nearly enough.
Well,
there's not
another
that many.
Thing. This is my personal idea. I think any boarding school is really cruel because it separates children from the parents.
It does.
And this is.
Separation from. Yeah, it's a separation from your parents. It's a separation from your land, your environment, your culture, and that's not really good. That doesn't make for a very happy person, really. And two, the other thing, of course, Indian youth many times will choose to go into the service or to the armed forces because there is nothing else. At least, if you go into the army, you go into the army for, 4 years, at least you have a chance to go see some place, and maybe, if you're lucky, you might learn a skill, a meaningful skill. But, again, that's not always the case either. But it is that, it is one avenue where you're readily accepted. You know, you want to maintain an army and... But,
did you ever serve in the army?
I was in the service twice. I was a paratrooper. I liked it very much. Of course, I enlisted with the full intention of being a paratrooper. Something that always fascinated me. And so I went into the service and I served my time, became a paratrooper, and came out and went to the University of Wisconsin. I didn't graduate. I dropped out of that, and then I became a structural iron worker, a steel worker. We put up high iron towers, buildings, and the like, bridges.
Is it true? We always read in books that the Mohawk are the people in building high bridges, and I was always surprised that it should be just one group or one nation. So in fact, it's so that. Do lots of Indians go into that kind of work?
The Iroquois Mohawk Nation are the most publicized in that, in that respect.
You get them even in German school books, pictures, and always says Mohawk steel workers.
I was an iron worker for 13 years, and I'm not a Mohawk.
No, this is the point, really, I wanted made. So could one say that... I mean, you probably need a lot of courage and skill to do that kind of work. Is it so that through your learning, through your environment, upbringing, you've become a very courageous, very skillful person?
I don't know anything about courage. It's something I never questioned. It's something I wanted to do. And it's a...